Welcome to Worlds Apart. In his drive to make America great again, Donald Trump promised to democratize American governance and make ordinary Americans stakeholders in their own system. But a year into his second term, many in his own party accused the White House of arrogance and of betraying America's first priorities. On the international front, the situation is not much better either. Why is it so hard for America to bridge the divide between preaching and practicing? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Robert Barnes, an American lawyer and political commentator. Mr. Barnes, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
I know that you've been and perhaps remain a supporter of Donald Trump, who has a lot of admirers in this country for his intention to break with the elitist hold on power. But a year into his second term, does it look like the president is going to deliver that democratization of power that he promised, not only in his own mind or in his speeches or in his social media posts, but in verifiable reality?
At the moment, it is not as hopeful as it was at the time of his inauguration. The president seems to have gone AWOL from his campaign promises and getting distracted by the various foreign adventurism that aspects of the American deep state have him entwined with, whether it's Venezuela, Nigeria, the Middle East, China, Russia, Ukraine, or elsewhere. And as long as that occurs, then he will re-experience what our founders understood, which is you cannot be a constitutional republic at home and an imperial empire abroad. The two are directly brought into contradiction and conflict with one another. And as long as he pursues the agendas of an empire abroad, then the hopes and opportunities to restore the republic at home will fail.
Now, the fact that the president has seemed to distance himself from his promises, is it his own failure or is it essentially embedded within the system that no president can change that?
One can make an argument that it is very difficult for a president, and even an elected president with the mandate President Trump came in with, to make the institutional reforms necessary to redirect the ship of state and ultimately to reverse its course entirely since the end of World War II. A huge administrative bureaucratic state that is almost parasitic to America's constitutional ideals has emerged in the post-World War II era, and it has been involved in and complicit with, as President Trump's own file disclosures have revealed, the assassination of one president, John Kennedy, the assassination of another presidential candidate, Robert Kennedy, the assassination of a range of leaders domestically and abroad, the various efforts to blackmail and sabotage those as represented and reflected in the Epstein files that President Trump himself became complicit in trying to cover up. So that aggregation of institutional rot continues to prohibit and preclude even elected presidents from implementing a mandate as radical and revolutionary to a degree in the modern era in America. And if Trump can't overcome it, the concern amongst the American populace will be maybe it can't be overcome unless the whole thing is just blown up entirely.
Now, you mentioned the word populist, and I heard you say before that populism is the driving force of American politics. It has always been, and to some extent, all American presidents were populist, meaning that they tried to anchor their campaign promises in people's aspirations. But given that fewer and fewer of those promises are getting realized, I wonder if the Americans themselves will ever grow tired of populism as a sort of as a genre of politics?
I think populism itself has nowhere to go aside from being deeper and widely held in the American countryside. And I don't think that will change at all. The question is whether it will change directions and expression in terms of political or unofficial political action, if you will, but also whether it changes the party structure itself. The United States tends to parallel the United Kingdom. And right now, the United Kingdom is seeing its two institutional parties' failure to address the popular concerns of the people and likely their complete demise within a half decade. The Tories and Labour likely will no longer exist. The same thing may happen in the United States if both the Republican and Democratic parties continue to utterly fail the American people's interest and desire to end the ambitions of empire and restore the ideals of the constitutional republic. Then we may see those two parties go the way of the dinosaurs. What you're really seeing across the Western world, across Europe, the United States, and elsewhere, is you see publics that want one thing and their elites that want the opposite. And the question is, how long is that sustainable? You could argue since the end of the Cold War, most Americans have wanted to restore, have a peace dividend, and to return back to a U.S.-based focus. And we've had multiple political insurrections, you might say, Patrick Buchanan, Ross Perot, Ralph Nader, and ultimately the ultimate one, Donald Trump. And so far, they have not been able to get their will expressed. Even when their ideas and ideals win the election, those who carry the mantle of that banner don't deliver on actual reform. And I think the longer they don't deliver on that reform, the more likely it is the party system collapses, and the more likely it is the system has to institutionally collapse before real remedy can occur.
You know, in my opinion, what distinguishes America from many other populist and populous countries, including Russia, is that it's only in the United States and perhaps in the EU that you can get away with so much politics and so little real governance. And I'm returning you your own question. How long do you think it will take until some meaningful changes emerge that will make a governing system into a vehicle for actually, you know, people's influence onto, you know, the lives that they see around them?
I think the clock is ticking as we speak. I think Trump was the last chance of the two-party system to deliver the reform and remedy that people want. And if Trump is unable to deliver on that reform, then they will look outside the two-party system for it. I think that is underappreciated by the corrupt parasitic class in Washington, D.C., that only cares about empire and doesn't care about people at home.
And Mr. Barnes, can I just can you please specify what do you mean by people looking outside the two-party system? What exactly can they do to, you know, have their own impact and run their country or their neighborhoods in accordance with their wishes?
Well, I think Elon Musk and Robert Kennedy were just a little ahead of the curve, maybe by a few years, because Elon Musk created a third party called America, the America Party, that it's still there. It's active. He's deciding whether to go back to his political engagement. Robert Kennedy, of course, ran as an independent candidate for president himself in 2024, and thereby is now part of the cabinet as Health and Human Services Secretary. Tulsi Gabbard was considering the same, and now she's the Director of National Intelligence. So we've already seen some degree of incorporation of these independent candidacies or would-be independent or third-party campaigns. And that is the usual route that it goes if it stays within the power structure, if it stays within the political system. And that's what I think you will see the first attempt at. And there's a long history in the United States of that prevailing. The Andrew Jackson's Democratic Party was a new party in 1828. Abraham Lincoln's Republican Party was a new party for the most part in 1860. And there's been various third-party challenges, including the People's Party of 1892, various progressive party and bull moose movements in the early 1900s, the Huey Long movement in the 1930s, before his assassination, the George Corley Wallace movement in the 1960s, followed up by the Ross Perot movement in the 1990s. So there's been, and then Ralph Nader in 2000. So you've had a range of independent third-party candidacies that have tended to shape the two parties that have usually, if they haven't been replaced, have borrowed from those third-party ideas and made them their own. If that doesn't happen or occur, then you might see other more extraordinary revolutionary acts. Mm-hmm. That I think the system is deeply unstable in ways that are under and unappreciated in the Capitol.
And yet in their efforts to reform the system, all American politicians of all political stripes, they keep referring to this founding fathers' ideals and the constitutional liberties. You yourself, I know, argued a couple of cases dealing with constitutional concerns, be it the freedom of speech or civil rights. And I've always been stricken by this American paradox because you lionize your own freedoms and how your country was created. You resent very strongly the centralization of power in other nations. And yet when it comes to practical realities, corporate America and the so-called deep state have such a huge influence, such a stifling hold on your system that it's it's impossible to change it through any democratic mandate. You yourself have elaborated on that. I wonder, though, if you can really change the system by going back to the future. I mean, I wonder if at this point, perhaps, the American founding myth is working against the America itself.
I think that what we have is a system that's disconnected from itself. We have an elite parasitic group of power that uses the language and rhetoric of our founders in order to justify and exculpate their own conduct when their own conduct is in direct contradiction. It's like a pastor who's engaged, a religious leader who, or a priest engaged in personal reprobate behavior that he's preaching against every Sunday. From the pulpit here in America's churches. That's what we have with our political leaders. They mouth about democracy and about Republican ideals that, you know, my cousin, President John Quincy Adams, you know, articulated repeatedly that we are not going to go abroad searching for monsters to destroy. And yet that is all we have done for the better part of the last century, using World War II as the excuse to do it. We're seeing that right now. Anytime any kind of peace negotiation is discussed with Ukraine or discussed on other matters, somehow it's 1938 all over again, which makes no sense to people who don't know their history. But that is it's a total disconnect. They use the language to get public buy-in of the ideas of our constitutional republic while betraying those very principles every single day in their conduct abroad. And to a large degree, as you note, their conduct at home.
But Mr. Barnes, is it only those politicians who do that? Because when I talk to my, ordinary American friends in the United States, all their arguments, political arguments usually come down to one sentence. We have the best system in the world, and despite being the best, it doesn't work completely. And, psychologically speaking, if we are adults, those two statements are mutually exclusive. You cannot have the best system in the world that you want to protect and that you have sworn, sacrosanct allegiance to, and at the same time believing, stating that it's not working. So as far as you're concerned, is it the best? Or is it actually malfunctioning, or is it dysfunctional at this point?
In its ideal, it's the best. When we divorce ourselves from it in daily practice, that is when the system tends to go awry and misfunction. And increasingly, we have a system that has been co-opted by a professional managerial class that is at odds with America's founding principles and doesn't come from the farmer laborer classes that created that system from its beginning and its origins. And the original American system could not sustain slavery because it was so oppositional to the ideas and ideals that created America, and thus abolition would come about within, a generation or two of its founding. The current system, when it malfunctions and misfunctions away from its principles and premises, cannot continue because precisely its divorce from its ideal. It is like someone preaching one way of life and practicing another. Mm-hmm. And as long as that continues to be the case, there will continue to be that divorce between ideal and reality that will distort the ultimate outcomes in ways that are against the interests and ideals of America's founders.
Now, other great powers, be they China or Russia, have gone through their own periods of major historical humiliations. And I think that allowed them in various ways to trim their imperial ambitions, to adjust their national identities, and to become a little bit more thrifty, a little bit more focused with their own resources. I wonder if you think that could happen to the United States, and if so, what form could it take?
I think we are infected by that Greek tragic sin of hubris in our imperial agendas, particularly those held by the professional managerial classes in positions of political power across the country, but at its peak in Washington, D.C. And what you always needed for hubris to be corrected is a nemesis. And we do need a nemesis, and Washington, D.C. does need a nemesis to be able to break through and breach that hubris mindset that has consumed so many of the people in the political capital. And it's unfortunate that we're going to, theoretically, Vietnam could have provided that opportunity. It did, maybe for a generation or so. But we need something of its equal to correct course back to our constitutional founding, because the hubris intoxicates Washington, D.C. in such a way that it is destructive to America's own freedoms and liberties, not to mention the rest of the world.
Okay, well, Mr. Barnes, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I try to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy.
Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
What planet are we living on now?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Robert Barnes, an American lawyer and political commentator. Now, Mr. Barnes, to many commentators in this country, President Trump seems rather genuine in his willingness to tackle many issues, but sincerity in politics, especially in geopolitics, is not enough. And President Trump markedly doesn't want to get bogged down into the complicated details of the very challenging issues that he intends to solve. Now, is it just him, or is it the feature of the American political culture in general, this inability to marry, practically marry, lofty rhetoric and the painstaking implementation?
Yeah, I think there's core problems that basically, like the United States Senate, in the Senate, those senators care far more about what's happening in Kiev than they do in their hometowns that they represent. That's why you have senators from places like South Dakota, a notoriously anti-war community going back over a century, and yet its senators are now some of the most warmongering senators in the Senate, like Senator Rounds and others. And so you have a disconnect between the political class and the voter class that continues to represent a problem with Congress, particularly in the U.S. Senate on matters of foreign policy. Then when any president gets elected, it's almost like the State Department and Defense, the Pentagon and the Defense Department gets handpicked by the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower, former general himself, warned about all the way back in 1961. The Treasury Department often gets selected from Wall Street to represent the interest of Wall Street, not the interest of the ordinary person, and global finance, which is increasingly a dominant portion of their profiteering. And then you have the State Department represented by the national security establishment, or what people like Mike Benz or others would call the blob of Washington, D.C., and they're representing those interests. And it's like the president is negotiating with them on a daily basis as to whether the American public's interest even gets any expression or manifestation in our own foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. I heard you say before that for the American deep state, World War II was a major success because it allowed them to use the post-war period to institutionalize themselves and create the kind of apparatus that remains in place regardless of who is elected. And Trump notably promised to change that both during his first term and during his second term. Do you think he's likely to succeed?
Unfortunately, unless he unleashes people like Vice President Vance, who is very sincere in that effort, people like Secretary Kennedy, whose father was murdered by the deep state, he has said so publicly, whose uncle, President John Kennedy, was murdered by the deep state. You know, I'm fond of saying that sometimes they say the sins of the father will be visited upon the son. Well, the sins against the father can be avenged by the son. And, you know, Robert Kennedy has afforded the opportunity for it. Members of his family have been placed in the intelligence infrastructure. And then both ODNI director Tulsi Gabbard and her deputy director, Joe Kent, whose own wife died from these foreign adventurism overseas in the Middle East, are people that are well equipped to know how to take apart this deep state infrastructure. The question is whether President Trump will have the courage to do so. So far, he has not shown the courage to do so. He's often excluded them from meaningful and consequential decisions in foreign policy overseas. He's been erratic and sporadic at utilizing their advice as to the conflict in Ukraine. He's currently considering going in and deposing the regime in Venezuela. Venezuela is just Spanish for Vietnam, except three times the size. And so, unfortunately, we're seeing only inconsistent efforts by President Trump to translate the public's will into deep-sixing the deep state. The deep state's just a construct that the Brits came up with in the 19th century called the dual state. It's what happens when you have an administrative bureaucracy independent and free from elections and the public's will and the public's control. And when you take that dual state and apply it to the national security apparatus, the military infrastructure, and the spying agencies, you get a deep state, as Peter Dale Scott detailed in 1969. And it's clear that the deep state runs our American foreign policy and dictates it wherever and whenever they do. And unless President Trump has meaningful criminal consequences to people like James Comey and Clapper and Brennan and these criminals that have been running the deep state for about a quarter century, then unfortunately the deep state will continue to be a parasite on the Constitutional Republic and make it ill until it dies.
Well, Mr. Barnes, I'm not a defender of the American deep state, but just to be the devil's advocate, in many other countries, the administrative state, if it's not beholden to corporations or other vested interests, provides the political leadership with a structural policy backbone that, institutional expertise that allows a leader to build on continuously rather than reinventing the wheel each time around. Don't you think that America perhaps will lose in the competition with other nations if its political and administrative structures remain so split?
The key problem of the administrative structures here I see is twofold. One, a professional managerial class, because we've both become obsessed with credentials and licensing in such a way that has disproportionately given power to a group of people that are disconnected from real life, that have never done real jobs with their own hands, never done real jobs and experienced the real private economy at all. You have people that all they've ever done is work for the government, and that usually doesn't produce the best outcomes in the United States. The second problem is the way in which what Robert Kennedy would call regulatory capture, that the best way for these agencies to maintain, get you promoted within these agencies, and ultimately to get good gigs after. Because a lot of these people that work at these agencies, their goal isn't to deliver the best government service, it's to deliver the best service for the people that are going to hire them after they leave. They retire with nice government benefits, but they only retire from the government. They don't retire from the economy. They then go to work for the very big institutions that regulate them, that they're supposed to be regulating and controlling. So ever since for the last century in the United States, our administrative agencies have been captured by the institutions they're supposed to be governing. And they actually serve those institutions, big private capital, big agriculture, big pharma, big military industrial complex, the academic national security establishment, all of these things that effectively corrupted those institutions, corrupted government at the same time, and in doing so, prevented both the public will from being represented and from good management to be done at the agency level.
Mm-hmm. Now, putting aside the agency level, it seems to be that the split has reached into the Republican camp as well. Just the other day, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a House member from Georgia, announced her upcoming resignation, claiming that President Trump and his team have departed from America First priorities and that they have been arrogant and dismissive of, their fellow Republicans. Do you find her claims valid? And I wonder if it's not only the problem with the deep state, but the overall problem with the American political culture, that has so much difficulty being civil, not only to the outsiders, but even among themselves.
Yeah, I think Marjorie Taylor Greene signifies and manifests the problem that exists in America's representative democracy today, that increasingly the donor class pre-screens who gets to run for office, who gets elected to office, who gets promoted once they're in office, who gets to cash out when they leave office. And this donor class often is as an interest in opposition to the voter class. And there's even been political science studies done in the United States that when a voter group, a representative's voters disagree with the representative's donors. Who wins out? 80% of the time, the representative picks the interests of the donors over the voters. Marjorie Taylor Greene breached through that with her populist campaign in Northwest Georgia near my hometown of Chattanooga, Tennessee. And I think she thought and saw herself as Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, the great Frank Capra film. She gets up there. They try to block her from committees. They make her life miserable. She stands her ground. She represents and defends the interests of the people in January 6th who were set up in what many people call a fedsurrection, not an insurrection, continues to believe in President Trump, stands by him through all of his tribulations and trials and troubles. And then when President Trump finally gets elected in 2024, she's confident and hopeful and aspirational that we will start to meaningfully reverse the course of state. And then she sees President Trump slowly, steadily get drained by the swamp rather than draining the swamp. Mm-hmm. She voices her objection and concerns, continues to advocate for full transparency of the Epstein files. And for all of that, she gets rewarded by President Trump by getting publicly attacked, called a traitor, all of these things. And I think for someone as idealistic and optimistic as Marjorie Taylor Greene was, it was the last blow to believing, okay, nothing can get done right now in Washington, D.C. It's a waste of time and a waste of space and a waste of place. So I think her departure should be a warning shot to D.C. that there's something seriously wrong with this city, that even the Marjorie Taylor Greens give up on being able to try to change it. But unfortunately, they'll continue to double down in their end of empire, Rome-style parasitic behavior towards the American public. And revolution will likely have to come from outside the Capitol in order to change the Capitol. It won't come from inside the Capitol, as Marjorie Taylor Greene's life experience in just half a decade provides the ultimate proof of.
Well, Mr. Barnes, I'm not sure that we have give up on Ms. Green. I mean, she has lots of followers in this country, too, who admire her for her spirit and for her ability to state what she believes in. There have been some rumors that she may be running for a governor or even president. I mean, given your sense for the American populism in this day and age, do you think she stands an electoral chance? And do you think if she's ever elected to the White House, do you think her performance would be any different from the performance of the current president?
Well, I think if she were put in a position of penultimate power, that she would make radical change because she truly believes in it. No better evidence of that than the fact that she resigned from Congress rather than cash in, that she stuck to her principles rather than betray them, that she was willing to even expose the president of the United States when he was failing to keep his principles. So she's a very principled individual. There's no question that if she wants and will seek a political future, she very much has one, that I think a public America's interest, and what people didn't understand, what Trump himself doesn't understand, is he was a manifestation of America's deep desire for radical change. And Trump likes to pretend he created MAGA. He rode MAGA. What he's always been very good at is listening to the public and replicating what they want. He didn't create the public interest in populism. He didn't create the public desire for radical change. They've been voicing it for more than 30 years now, going back to the little billionaire Ross for Boss Perot. So they've been demanding and screaming for change. And Trump was a primal scream of the American public against our political class to radically reverse course. And instead, they just double down, ignore it, won't heed it. And right now, President Trump is listening to the Lindsey Grahams of the world playing golf with him rather than listening to the people, the ordinary, everyday people who put him into power and to change all of this in the first place, to kick the Lindsey Grahams out of the club, not to join him at the club.
Well, Mr. Barnes, I think that's a good summary of where the American political life stands at the moment. And the only thing I want to add is that the Americans are very hopeful people, perhaps far more optimistic than the reality calls for it. So perhaps they will give another chance to a populist politician, and he or she may change things around. But for the time being, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.